Hi, my name is John Kim. I'm a therapist who went through his own rebirth many years ago, and I've been documenting my journey ever since, sharing my life lessons and revelations. I believe in casual over clinical, with you instead of at you. I come unrehearsed on purpose because self-help doesn't have to be so complicated. So I'm super excited about this conversation because you guys aren't just guests, but there's history here. There's a lot of, collisions and catalysts and unfolding and connecting dots and, you know, coming full circle, all of that stuff happening. So let's start with intros. Let's start with who they are.
Do you want me to give the intro?
No, they should. I think they should.
The intro.
Yes.
You want them to do it?
Yes. You want to start?
Intro yourself.
Ashley?
That's a professional.
Oh, I would love for Vanessa to intro me. That would be amazing. She's so good.
Okay, let's make it fun. Let's let Vanessa intro you through the perspective of her 20-something-year-old self when she found you and you became one of the greatest catalysts of her life.
So my acting like I'm in my 20s?
No. Don't act. Just
see if you can do that. Access that part of self.
Yeah, exactly. Paint us the picture. New York, you were, you know, whatever, 20-something.
Right. So currently, from the year 2022, Ashley is both a psycho-spiritual counselor and an intuitive medium. Right. That is what you currently do. And you've always kind of done that. But, for those listening who don't know, so I met Ashley when I was 25, a wee 25-year-old, which is crazy now on this day of my birth. 38 years old.
Oh yeah, today's her birthday.
Look at that. How about that?
I was doing the math.
Ashley, how old were you when she was 25?
I'm 10 years older. So yeah. 35. Yeah, 35.
So she was younger than you are now. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Babies.
It's wild. Babies. And so Ashley was my first therapist. And she changed my life. It was a huge, it was one of those pivotal relationships for sure. That is kind of the reason I am who I am and I'm on the path that I'm on. And Ashley was the one that, just opened up all kinds of doors and holy shit moments and all of those experiences that most of us have with our first therapist.
How can I ask you this? How did she change your life? Be a little more specific. In what way?
I think Ashley was really pivotal in me really taking ownership of my life, unpacking a lot of things that I was very blind to in intergenerational patterns. We'll just say that. some relationships and intergenerational patterns and how those play out in my life. She really changed my life for the better. I mean, I was prompted to go to her by a friend of mine who's unfortunately no longer a friend, but who said to me, you're so angry. You're just so angry all the time. Like, maybe you should go to this therapist who I see. And just really kind of opened my life to like what kind of possibility there could be outside of just like going to the state of exhaustion, giving, no boundaries, resentful, fucking angry all the time.
The angry therapist should have been your thing.
Yeah.
Not mine.
At 25, it for sure should have been my thing. and then I met
she
Lair.
Might have qualified. Because,
all of us at some point, right? Lair is Ashley's husband, but also Lair was my couple's therapist in my last relationship that expired, as it should have. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had some of his wisdom as well at a small part of my journey. And now I just feel like at this point, I mean, life changers, but also colleagues, which is great to say.
That's right.
It's really fun. It's fun to be in this space.
Yeah. And Lair, just for the...
It's just to have seen you.
Sorry.
What's that?
I was just going to say to give the actual intro. So Lair is also a therapist, LMFT, and also the author of a new book, which John has right here, The Practice of Love.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk about. Yeah.
Yeah,
you
it's
got
a great
it?
Book, by the way.
Yeah,
there it is. And I love that.
and notes.
Yeah, I love that you go in through the door of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Which I think is, I don't know. I think that word is very thrown around, and I think a lot of people use the word, don't practice it much, but using it as a way into relationships, I think, is amazing.
Yeah.
So where do you want to start?
Yeah, I needed a ramp. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the ramp. I mean, if I were to say like, what's my connection to you all? One of the biggest I would say is that you both opened my world around, you know, mindfulness and the healing power of it. I mean, not just individually, but how we relate to the world, which includes our relationships, right? So it's, I always talk to clients about, you know, mindfulness is not like, it's not an activity like lifting weights. I mean, it becomes an integral part of who you are. It becomes like a part of your life, your soul, your personality, you know, when you really do practice it. And it changes everything about you when you really do embody the practice fully.
That could be the same with lifting weights.
I think that's well said.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. It's, you know, but it's like a way that you live and you breathe. Oh, yeah, I guess the same goes for people who are really crazy into lifting weights.
Laird, what is your relationship with mindfulness? Why did you choose to go in through that door? And then finally, tell us about how to relationship better using mindfulness.
Yeah, so Ash and I went to the Helix training program in New York, which was this 4-year, very eclectic, multidisciplinary training program. It was founded by 5 women in the 70s. And they really sought to kind of turn psychotherapy on its head and say, look, it's not just about the Western modes. And so we spent 4 years kind of studying all different kinds of things, including Peruvian shamanism, lots of Jungian stuff and clinical modalities. But when we came across the Buddhist psychology and the mindfulness piece, I was like, that really spoke to me, primarily because this is what I was not a clinician, right? And here I am trying these things that I'm reading in these books to, you know, work on my own life and my own brain. And there was no ramp to these things. And what mindfulness did for me personally, and what it ultimately does for my couples, I think, is it allows them an opportunity to stop, to push pause, to take a breath, to titrate the nervous system, and to stop looking externally, but to look internally, right? And especially with couples, I find that, like, you know, there's a lot of like, well, and that external go. There's not a lot of traction there, but there's a ton of traction in what am I doing? Where am I? Where am I on that Richter scale 4, 5, 6? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? When I sought to kind of put my own methodology of working with couples together, one of the first things they say in any, in the big book of couples therapy, whatever Western mode you're working, they say, de-escalate the couple cycle. Period. They don't tell you how to do that. Yeah. They just say, de-escalate the couple cycle. And if you're a clinician and you're working in the room with a couple, that's maybe easy enough. You can go, hey, guys, calm down, take a breath, let's stop. But I needed to give something to couples that they could use, the tool that they could take with them. Something that they, a commonality, a common language, a common practice, where they can say to each other, hey, can we just stop and take a pause and take a breath? And be, you know, you take that breath, you begin titrating the nervous system down. And what I found is it was getting my couples out of their knee-jerk responses to each other. And that was a big, big plus. And so I started there, and it became the universal remote, the all access pass and skeleton key, as I like to say in the book, to the other practices, set them up. Prior to using that with couples, it was hard for me to get them to stop and look at their parts, to check in with their narrative, to work some sort of EFT scenario, or to understand their attachment issue, because they were so activated. And so in that way, it became that onboarding process. If I could stop things, let them take that pause and begin to look internally instead of externally, that was really helpful. And that started the book. Yeah.
You said knee jerk, which I can relate to. And also it just kind of like flashed in neon for me. That seems to be one of the biggest problems in relationships, people allowing the knee jerk, allowing, you know, the reaction instead of the response. So then mindfulness kind of becomes this emotional speed bump that stops the knee jerk, and then your reaction becomes a response. There's more thought. And so that itself, I think that's where the road forks, and that itself can break patterns, create the space to look inward, and also give people the opportunity to take ownership. So that's a huge game changer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that's why it was step one. I thought it would ultimately be the biggest piece of the of all the practices, the common denominator piece. Ultimately, what I found was, and I wanted it to be because I was such a big mindfulness guy, I was such a freak for it and thought it was so powerful. Ultimately, what became the common denominator practice for me with couples is personal responsibility. Because if you're not taking responsibility for your mindfulness, if you're going to allow yourself to go off the rails and not take that pause, how are we doing?
Well, I think like mindfulness, like you said, if we look at it as the ramp, right? I mean, it's the ramp, but it's not to say that it's not work in itself, but it's not the work, right? Like it's the thing that allows you to do the work. It's That's the well foundation said. From which the work is done. It's not the work itself, at least in the relationship, right? And I think for me, I know in my personal experience, never having any training in that, never having any prior experience with that, when I started building that foundation, that was when all of the other pieces started falling into place and all of the other issues, for lack of a better term, started popping up. And I started being able to go, oh, there's that thing, but I wouldn't have seen that thing had I not gotten slow enough, quiet enough, still enough, internal enough, you know, to actually see it.
I have a question. This isn't from me. This is me channeling from my audience. Why should I take responsibility if my partner's not doing shit? Why should I go first?
Well, we got to ante up and we want to show up in our adult selves. And, you know, in the book, I talk about the love embargo and we sort of stand behind that embargo of like, I'll do better when you do better. And nothing can happen. No traction.
Oh, that's a tug of war.
Yeah.
And so here we are, and that can last for years. I mean, when you get into the if he would only or if she would just or the love embargo or the tug of war, the relationship has two places it can go. It either stagnates and stays the same. We just sort of look across the table like I fucking need you guts. Or it collapses. And so movement at that point in any direction, I think, is better than none. And so going first, we might put our feet to the path of I'm out of here because I need to be. This is unhealthy. If you're not doing your work, you're not showing up for me. Mm-hmm. You're not showing me that I'm loved, that I'm safe, that I'm enough, that I matter, helping me with all that internal stuff. So I probably need to exit. And so I'm going to step forward and say, let's have a conversation. Let's have a difficult talk. Let's figure out where we're going or where we're not going.
Me at 49 and, you know, 12 years post divorce and lots of other relationships, it's still hard for me to put my fingers down and say that, hey, this is something I need to own. I will go first. It's so much easier to play chess or to wait for the other person to make the first move and then say, oh, okay, now I'll do the dishes.
If you're really smart, obviously, and then you obviously are, you know, that you can sit back and play that and play chess and you're probably good at it. Yeah.
I would say too, a lot of times when I talk to clients, I talk about like short-term versus long-term. Like, sure, you can have short-term gain by playing those cards and by not owning and by doing the same thing you've always done, you know, the people pleasing, whatever the bullshit quality, right? But are you in it for the short-term or for the long-term? Because, you know, long-term, that's not going to get you where you want to go. Like short-term, it's going to alleviate that anxiety in the moment for a brief pause, but it's just going to build up for it later on, right?
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on all this? Yeah, and by the way, can I just say real quick, I was observing both of you and
as a therapist would.
No. Well, something caught my eye and this is really interesting. Larry, while you were talking, Ashley was looking at you like this for the entire time. Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's so awesome. It's so, I don't know how to explain it, but usually, you know, when you're in front of the camera, both people are looking forward, but she was listening and I was like, oh shit, I don't do that. And I thought that was really cool that she was engaged in you and not, you know, checking her hair or seeing that. You must have told her, gave her instructions before we started.
I let her know. Listen, I need to shine here. Well, no, I was going to say too, that like, I don't, you know, as we all do, we're humans and we're clinicians and therapists and coaches and whatever we're doing. I still have to push that mindful pause button when I need to, and I know I need to own my shit. And it's like, there's a part of me that when we, you know, when we rarely get into it, because obviously things are very clean on the side, that I have this part of me that it's like he puts his lips to my ear and he goes, now you get to say some fucked up shit. And I'm like, what? Wait, I know. Yeah, do it. Do it. And I look across the table and I see that face and I'm like, oh, and there's still that dog fight. Yeah. Of like, you get to fight for the victim position. You get to fight to be right. And this, that part of me in that compartment of my brain, I forget that this is a zero sum game. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if I really love her, I don't want her to lose anything. And so that moment of like pause allows for the rest of that to come in and I can toggle between those aspects of self, and that wise self can drop in and go, I know where this is going to take us. And this is practice, man. That's why I called it the practice of love. And make a better choice, choose her in that moment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Choose her over you. Yeah. And I want to hear, like John said, I want to hear Ashley kind of your perspective, but I also want to put a pin in and come back to, cause that feels like a good segue into talking about one of the areas of your book. You talk about a culture of reverence, and I feel like this is a really good, we're going to come back to this because I want to talk.
I think John found it though in the look.
That's exactly it. You know, and I know you write about it, Lara, but I also, and the funny thing is because I saw both of you at a similar time in my life, I don't actually remember which one of you told me, but I remember hearing a story from one of you about a point in your relationship where you had a realization that the kind of relationship you wanted to be in was not the kind of relationship where you spoke to each other like that.
You remember that one?
Yeah. And I don't even remember like which one of you said it and at which point, but like, I remember it coming to me and it's mm-hmm. stuck with me. And I'll tell you, well, first I want to ask you, either one of you really, to talk about reverence and the importance of reverence in a relationship, if you could, for the listeners.
No, wait, hold on. Because we're still waiting for Ashley.
I know.
We're going to say, Ashley, okay, we want you to speak and then we're going to go on to, but let's do
this.
And
is
then,
the
and
three extroverts in the room. And, damn it.
Totally. It's chewing scenery here.
I think what would be really funny is we go for an hour and Ashley doesn't say a word, but we keep
that
saying, Ashley,
that might happen
easily.
And then we overtalk that. So
extroverts are the worst.
We ironically don't practice mindfulness in the actual episode to show people.
No, why would we do that?
Anyway, Ashley, okay.
So
what are your thoughts?
I'm having so much fun watching y'all's dynamic. It's really interesting. It's great. Okay, so where am I starting? Should I start with mindfulness?
Start wherever you want, just your thoughts.
What's coming
on,
up?
Yeah.
I'd like to add mindfulness because it's come up a lot lately with clients and couples dynamics. And I hear people say it's too hard. And I'm like, what's hard? Especially in relationship to themselves. I'm like, isn't it exhausting listening to your mind all the time and everything that it tells you? But when I actually had someone say this to me the other day, like, sometimes I just want to be an asshole and let them accept it. I just want them to hold me as I be an asshole. And then they admitted that wouldn't go well for them. But I thought, why would you want to be an asshole to someone you love? Like, it doesn't even make sense to me. Now, granted, like I'm known, like we had an argument the other day and I said some really shitty things and man, was he mindful. He just sat in the corner of the room, like holding all the energy. And I was like, wow. I was just a real shitbag.
I did that knowing we were coming here this week.
So we can talk about it.
But truthfully, you know, I don't think we can afford not to be mindful. And one of the things that mindfulness taught me is I spent time being a victim to my story, like a lot of time being a victim of my story, to my PTSD, to my trauma, to my pain, to my suffering. And when I became mindful, it was the first time like I could choose differently. And I realized I don't want to be a victim anymore. So when people tell me, it's too hard, or I can't. I just disagree. I'm like, you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice. Like, you and your partner are doing the same thing to the point where it's escalating over and over again, and you're going to sabotage or destroy this or this person or each other. And that just looks awful to me. So I think mindfulness, it's like oxygen, it's air, but it definitely helps us just take control of ourselves and take control. And even if that person isn't showing up for me, but my God, I want to show up better for me. I don't want to leave this relationship going, I was the worst version of myself. And then I have to process that. I can maybe go walk away this with grace or some like dignity, because there were times, going back to what you said, Vanessa, I was really disassociated when we first met and I didn't know.
When we first met.
Yeah. When we first met. Sorry. when we first met.
No, she was totally not disassociated during that at all.
No, I was really dissociated. And I remember we would get in an argument. I didn't know how to do relationships, and I would black out, like black out in rage or black out just from dissociation. I didn't know what was going. All I knew was like chaos and like really intense volatility. And I remember one day he woke up and he said, "I never want to talk to each other like that again." And all I needed him was to say that once. And this blows my mind when couples go through this over and over again. I'm like, it literally for me, and I don't know what the difference is, but it took him once to say, "Let's not talk to each other. No name calling, no threats to leave the room. Let's not do that anymore." And then, I mean, honestly, we haven't called each other a name in probably 20 years. We just don't.
Well, that dovetails nicely into reverence, because right. That builds reverence when you put that person in the place of, and we all have these people in our lives. And I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it doesn't mean I don't say shitty things sometimes, but we don't engage in
She's way better at this shit than I am, by the way. She's just a better human than I am. But I think it dovetails nicely into reverence, because when you put someone in that place of, you know what, I just don't talk to that person that way. I tell them the truth, and I'm not trying to candy coat my feelings, but we all have these people, whether they're clients or maybe it's a loved one or a child or a friend, that we are almost automatically mindful. Like, I know I want to keep this friendship, but somehow familiarity, a marriage license, children, bank accounts, car loans, that gives me the sense that I've got a few at bats with you. And so though you're my loved one, I'm just going to kind of, you know, take a shortcut here and talk to you shitty. Really? How's that going to go over the course of time together? Why not stop, push pause, and I don't know what that was. After a tequila filled night, we had a terrible fight the night before. We woke up hungover in my crappy New York apartment. And I remember looking at her and saying, "I never want to call you a name like that again. And I never want to talk to each other like that again." And we shook on it. And she said, "Okay, I honestly don't." I think that was the crux of the beginning of that mindful practice. And it was the beginning of reverence in our relationship. And so now the example we have for each other and the example we have for our boys, quite frankly, and I think other couples think we're totally Pollyanna-ish and we're not, is that we treat each other kindly and with dignity all the time. I mean, this is the person I want holding my hand when I take my last breath on earth. This is the person I chose to make other people with. I should probably be nice to her, at least. Treat her with reverence.
So I love this, and I think this is a good... Okay, so what's coming up for me, and one of the things that I really appreciated about the book, and I've always appreciated about you two as clinicians, is your ability to be transparent, right? And I think that John and I are very similar, and I think that's also anything that we do together as a couple. I think people really appreciate that. You know, in our book, it's the same way. It's like we will go into like, this was the fight, or this is the continual fight that we have, right? And so... this is really interesting, because if I'm hearing this as you know, a listener, I think, well, I don't name call, right? Like, I don't call my partner names. But what I will say, this is a conversation that John and I have had a couple times around the way that we speak to each other. And I've brought this up, right? And now him and I have both brought it up a few times, where I'm like, sometimes when we're really stressed out, I don't like the way we talk to each other. And we don't name call, right? We're not throwing around like fuck yous or anything like that. But it's this tone of I was going to say condensation, but that's not correct. Right. Being condescending.
Condescending.
Thank you. Condescending. That I don't love, right? And so the reason why I'm bringing it up is it's like, well, if it's not as extreme as name calling, but it's that. It's this like, I walk away from it going, oh, I don't like that. He doesn't like it. And yet we still occasionally fall into this pattern, right? What would be maybe something that somebody listening, who I'm sure has a similar kind of dynamic, would be able to implement or institute, if you will, that could help unravel maybe a less extreme version of that?
Can you give me an example of what that less extreme version would be? I mean, I guess it could be almost anything.
Yeah, snapping. I mean, it would be the condescending.
Snapping.
Talking like, to them like
well,
they're stupid.
So I would say
talking to them like they're stupid. I think that's a really good way to put it, Ashley.
Yeah, talking to them like they're stupid. I think it requires two of the practices, right? You push pause and you notice as you're walking away that face that you made, you're like, ugh, like that made me feel like shit. Yeah. And so you notice how it made you, and then maybe take responsibility for it. And that's what it requires, right? Like, I don't want to do that to this person anymore. But look, we're Americans and we win shit. And that does not stop here. Mm-hmm. We're used to fighting for even the victim position. I wouldn't have said that if you hadn't said that.
Yeah.
Right. And so, maybe you're not name calling. And maybe I don't know exactly what it is for each and every listener out there, but I'm going to bet you could tune up your game with your partner as far as reverence is concerned. If we look at the definition of the word, it's that exalted, that place of awe and esteem that you hold this person in, right? And again, we have these people in our lives that we put them in this place, and we speak to them kindly, we speak to them compassionately, we take time to make sure. Maybe we always tell them the truth about how we feel, and I think that's important. We don't candy coat it. We talk about our feelings rather than through them, which is the key piece, right? Yeah, like if I talk about my feelings, it's as if it's like this cup sitting here. It's, brown and it's kind of pewtery looking, I guess. But if I'm talking through my feelings, that's a whole nother thing. That's name calling. There's a lack of reverence. There's a lack of kindness. It comes at you. But when I tell someone, I'm really angry with you right now. And what's more, I think I'm really disappointed in the way that you talked to me, the way that you treated me. Mm. Well, now we're getting to something, we're having a totally different conversation. 9 times out of 10, that doesn't feel so personal, doesn't feel so pointed. And that person can say, I hear you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we're relating differently.
So, well, again, the "I hear you," I think, mm-hmm. is great, and that's growth. Usually, people say, "Yeah, but what about when you did this to me on that day?" And what about And that's when the ropes picked up and held on. Let me ask you this: how much of the way that we talk to each other comes from our upbringing, culture, the residue
great
from
question.
The past, right? The great. Patterns of yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So, please. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I think it's a good question because I think it depends on how much healing work we've done. I would say at this point, if I snap at you or talk to you in a way, it's not about my past. It's about my nervous system. Yes. It's about how wound up I am, how stressed I am.
Explain that. Can you go deeper on that?
Go deeper into the nervous system part. Yeah.
So, I wouldn't talk to him the way my family talked to me or our family dynamics. I've done enough healing work to recognize it's not even a part of who I am. It's just not in me. But if my nervous system is wound up, if I'm stressed, if I'm in my head and my head's worried about all these things and I'm tired and I'm not present, then if he comes to me and I'm trying to think of a situation, I could snap. I could be like, okay, or just talk to him in a disrespectful way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more about nervous system if you're doing your work.
If
you're doing your work, then rather repeating a culture of family or your past.
I think it does happen though. Obviously, I think you drag your culture, your familial culture with you.
You do. But I think if you're have done enough personal work, mm-hmm. I think you can really disengage from that culture.
I don't feel like you and I
carry that in our relationship, mm-hmm. our cultures of our families at all. I think it's more about our nervous system and what we're actually thinking about rather than being really present in the moment and being present for what's happening between us.
Why didn't you help me include that in the book? That's a good one.
I've never been asked the question.
She didn't want you to be successful.
She didn't want to take the nugget.
Hey, so let me ask you this, because then can that be the prescription? Dropping into your body, being aware of your nervous system as a way to, for that to be the radar or, to gauge mindfulness. Most people don't,
they don't track.
There's no awareness, there's no tracking.
Yeah.
They're not tracking. So
so what do you mean by tracking?
So I feel like there's a moment, like we're building resentment. We're telling a story about that person. They're not helping me out. I'm doing all these things. But I think there's a moment where we have to watch the narrative we're telling. I'll just use an example of someone that said, I feel like I'm doing all these things for my partner and I'm doing a lot of housework or I'm doing food and things like that. And this person was getting really resentful, but her partner never asked her to do those things. She was doing them because she has space and time. But what was happening is she spent her morning doing these things and her nervous system started getting wound up. The story she was telling about these things, mm-hmm. about doing domestic work, about managing the food. And before you know it, she was just like about to explode. Mm-hmm. And then her partner comes in one small interaction and she's lost it. Mm-hmm. And what we noticed when we broke it down, there were moments that she was cleaning the kitchen or planning the grocery list, or, you know, this is just mundane tasks, that she noticed, I noticed I was getting irritable. Mm-hmm. You know, I noticed I was feeling like, I don't want to do this anymore. I noticed I was getting tired. I noticed I was losing patience. And all those moments that she could have stopped and had some self-care, breathe, you know, what am I telling myself? And so often our nervous system is about what we're thinking. You know, she could have told a story, and we talked about this, that, you know, my partner works a lot and I'm not doing a lot right now. So I really like keeping our space clean. It's not my favorite thing to do, but I know it helps keep our environment less chaotic and stuff. But instead her mind was like, you know, you're worthless. Why are you doing this domestic work? You know, all this stuff. And the mind was creating this physical and nervous system response. And then by the time her partner walked in the room, she was ready to go.
Well, I think that's a really good point, the mind, because, you know, I think a really simple way I've heard it broken down is like, your nervous system doesn't know the difference between reality and imagination,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's exactly
so like,
right.
Yes. All of us, everybody listening can relate to like, when you're watching a scary movie, you can feel your heart racing, you can feel that's your palms right. sweating, you feel that anxiety. Obviously, you know, like if I pull myself out of my body, I know that it's not real, but my nervous system doesn't know that. That's why it responds in that way, right? So what you're saying is so powerful, because if you really step back and use your mind, you actually have the ability to kind of help regulate your nervous system in that moment with your mind.
You have to track. I mean, I think so much of what we do, we have to track. Over and over again throughout our days, we have to check in. How am I doing? I'm a parent. I have to track. How am I responding to my children? How am I feeling about them bouncing off the walls, making noise? It's tracking. He's talking to me about something that he may want me to work on. I have to track my response to it.
But you know, it's tracking. The toughest thing about mindfulness is remembering to do it.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part of it, I think, for most people.
But if you do it long enough, I think it becomes muscle memory.
Sure.
I think if you do it long enough, it becomes part of who you are. And granted, some days are more than others, but I think it becomes a part of your daily existence. I'm tracking. I know the importance of this.
More habitual.
If this was a book, insert a little black box. Tracking is what?
Vital to regulation.
Noticing.
Oh, tracking is definition. Oh,
noticing.
Yeah.
Noticing.
Yeah.
A lot of people watching or listening to this, stumbled upon it because they found the wrong John Kim, because there's a lot of John Kims on this planet. And so for people like that, tracking is
noticing.
And I love that it's just one word. It's noticing.
Noticing. Mm-hmm. So, well, I wish I could take responsibility for that. That's Ellen Langer out of Harvard. She's been writing about mindfulness since the early 70s, back when it was like some fringy ooga booga. Mm-hmm. And people are like, what are you talking about? And she's written 22 papers and 11 books on the subject, and she will break it down to, and you'll love her delivery if you've not seen her. It's very like over the kitchen table. And she says, yeah, it's stopping and just noticing. We can be mindful in this moment. If you don't have to meditate for an inordinate amount of time in order to become mindful in your everyday. And she said, here, look, you want to change your relationship? Here's how you do it. You go home and notice 4 or 5 new things about your partner as you walk in the door. And watch what happens. And I was like, shit, that's solid.
I work with people a lot on this idea, especially with women, on this idea of like your 1 to 10, right? So this idea of tracking just reminded me of this. It's like, cause I do this with myself. If I know that my 10 is like, that's my snap. That's my, I'm snippy. I lash out, I yell, whatever my response is. You know, the problem for a lot of us is we don't notice when we're at a 3 to like a 7. Like we don't notice it until we're at an 8. And by the time we're at an 8, we're already 1 foot out the door to the 10, then the 11, then the 12, right? And so I think so much of the work with tracking, and in the beginning, the tracking does, the mindfulness does show up as like, oh, I'm at a 10. What does that feel like, right? And then eventually you notice when you're at a 9 and then an 8. And really the work is like, can I figure out when I'm going from that 2 to a 5? Because that's the sweet spot. Because if I can figure out what that alarm bell is in my body, oh, I'm at a 5, then in that moment I can do that practice of self-care, like you said, Ashley. And then if I do that, then I can still hold my partner with reverence, right? If we're bringing it back to couples or even my children, like I can hold my child with reverence.
Every relationship is affected by that. Yeah. That's one of the things that helped turn couples work for me was that everything is so external with couples. Like I'm watching you and what you're doing and what you just said to me and what's going on here, and stopping and pushing pause and looking internally. Well, that was like, what are you even talking about? Why would I do that? This is happening here. I'm like, no, it's happening here first. that's when you can begin to notice the rapidly increasing 3, 4, 5. I'm getting there.
Yeah.
So spot on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we swerve a little bit? Laird, what's your love language?
Physical touch and physical touch.
physical touch.
I like it when, it's funny you ask, because I feel like our love languages are attached to our core wounds. And, mm-hmm. you know, as I even continue to do my work, I've uncovered, like, I didn't think the world was an unsafe place to the little parts inside of me. And so I've recently discovered that, like, the world's a friggin' unsafe place to some parts of me that I've kind of just discovered. Mm-hmm. And so my love language has kind of shifted. And I think it was words of affirmation. Like, I'm, you know, aesthetically, I am a white male in America. I'm never going to be enough. I'm never going to earn enough money. I'm never going to, you know, do enough. I'm never going to be enough. Some of that's changed. Like, I feel like it's physical touch, but that also allows, it makes me know that I'm safe. It makes me know, I like knowing that I'm safe with her, that she picks me in whatever way she chooses to do that. And so, yeah, words of affirmation for sure. I don't even know if I could pick out one, because it does feel like, depending on the part of whatever young part I'm in,
yeah,
maybe that love language changes a little bit and I need to know something else.
Oh, that's something interesting. Like that. Yeah. So love language, not being a constant, but varying depending on what part you're in. Ashley, what about you? What's your love language?
I'm the worst. I didn't read the book. I've heard about it. I know there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I didn't read the book either, but, you know, acts of service,
affirmation,
gifts.
She does. You like gifts. You do.
I like gifts. I also love physical contact. It makes me feel like, okay, we're here. You're here with me. I love like the bed made. I love that, you know, because my bed can be triggering to me for different reasons, but although I don't make it.
No, it's nice when I do.
So I would say I don't need words of affirmation as much as I like physical contact, and that way in connection. And
it's really like when I send her the message that I was thinking of her when she wasn't there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one. Now, however that gets disseminated, whether it's, cause it doesn't, she's not like jewelry or anything like that. It's flowers. Oh, you were at the store and you saw flowers and you thought of me.
On pair of socks.
Or like, you know, I was at the surf shop the other day and I saw this cute little sweater and I was like, gosh, you look awesome in that. I snapped it up.
Yeah, I like
that. Yeah, she likes that kind of stuff.
Thoughtfulness.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like the way that you guys are breaking it down. Feels more like, I hear so many times, and we even talk about this, like if we have conflicting languages, it can be tough, I think, for a lot of people. And I like the way that you are breaking it down. Feels more, it's just allowing that person to know that you're thinking about them. It's allowing that person to know that, you know, it's the thoughtfulness, and however that manifests, it sounds like it can be enough for the other person, as long as you know that you're being thought of. I know, like, John and I have struggled quite a bit, at least in the beginning of the relationship too, where he's definitely a words of affirmation person and I really struggle with words. So I'm an extrovert. I can, you know, talk to a brick wall and it could be a riveting conversation, I assure you. And yet when it comes to, like, you know, commending the people I love, I mean, I don't struggle with my kids.
4 years and she still hasn't said I love you back.
Shut up. It's not the I love you. It's more of the, like, you know, you're so wonderful and here's why. Like those kind of words of affirmation, like, I get very tripped up in them. I can write them. I can't speak them.
Yeah.
And so we struggle with that. And then mine is acts of service. And so he's struggled where he's like, I don't understand how that can make someone feel loved. And so all that to say, I think the way you put it is beautifully, because it's less about like, what box do you fit in? And more about like, does your partner feel like you are thinking about them? Does your partner feel like they're on your mind?
Yeah. I like to drill down a little bit further beyond those, because I had couples come in and I would say, anecdotally speaking, maybe 90% of the couples that I've seen over the number of individuals, frankly, over the years, had probably read that book. And to a person, they'll say, you know, I think I am a 1, 3. She's a 4. We got to read that book again. Yeah. And Yeah. And so then I wanted to drill down a little bit further, and I was like, so what are these related to? And so sort of started perusing the notion that when we come through the gates of life, we're asking questions. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at that little baby of yours and she's asking some questions. Am I safe? Am I loved? Am I enough? And do I matter? It sort of dovetails on what Rogers said when, you know, he came up with the sort of the humanistic approach to therapy. And he said, your clients are looking for something they did not get. That was a lightning bolt moment for me. I'm like, well, what the hell is that? I need to know what that is. He's like, yeah, you need to know that. And I found that I think it's, am I safe? Am I loved? Am I enough? And do I matter? Are there more? Perhaps. But these are the ones I'm working with. And these are the ones I included in the book. And I think that our love languages are attached to that. Mm-hmm. And I was reading Stephen Johnson's book, Character Styles. If you're a therapy nerd, pick it up. It's hard to read. But I was reading the book and I came across what I thought was her character style. And Johnson said, for this character style, this person, the world has been in a largely unsafe place. Well, yeah, totally. And the people who were supposed to love this woman the most in the world didn't. The people who are supposed to keep her the safest didn't. And so when she came through the door that day, she had a particularly tough day. And this is a story that I included in the book. And I felt like I suddenly had the answer key to my relationship, right? I didn't try to fix it. I didn't have to speak a love language. I just wrapped my arms around her and she was, and you know, had some tears. And I said, I know, sweetie. I said, sometimes the world just seems like an unsafe place.
Yeah.
She pulled back and she's like, who the hell is this guy? Right. Yeah. And so I think those are important. Those questions are important because they do inform our love languages. But I feel like if you can get to know your partner's wounding in that way, what they did not get, then maybe you're cooking with some more gas.
Well, but this is where I think attunement comes in. And like you said, yeah, maybe the, right. I can't remember which one of y'all said, but maybe it's not the love language for that all the time. Maybe they're changing. But if you're attuning to your partner and what's going on for them and what they might need, mm-hmm. you know, and not to fix them or make them feel better, but, you know, just what might create a softer environment for them or just might let them know that you love them, that might change if you're attuning to.
Well, why not want to be the person, the one person in the world who did make it safe, the one that showed up and tried to do something, even though this isn't necessarily how I'm wired, words of affirmation or whatever, or acts of service. But like, here's a grand opportunity for me to love this person the way she's never been loved before. Holy shit. Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna throw something out there though. This is a bit of a challenge.
Codependency.
Bring it. All right. So let's go into this world though, right? Of working towards interdependency in relationships. Mm-hmm. Yes. Ideally, my partner knows my deepest wounding and can really step up and help me heal those parts of myself, right? Notice I said help me heal those parts of myself. Yep. And there, at a certain point, it is actually my responsibility to know what my needs are, be very clear about them, and also be able to sit with that need and say, how much of this is my responsibility, right? So if I don't feel safe, right, it's not necessarily, I'm not saying you're saying this, but it's like not necessarily my partner's responsibility to make sure I know that I am safe, right? Like part of this is me questioning, like, why don't I feel safe? And like, what do I need to do for myself to make sure that I feel safe in how I move through the world, right? And I do think that there's this line, and I'm noticing it more and more in the way I work with couples, where it's like, everybody's talking about needs right now, right? Like I have needs and my needs, they're not meeting my needs. And it just feels much more finger pointy where I'm like, girl, fill your needs. Guy, fill your needs. Like, don't expect somebody else to fill your needs, right? And so, I'm not like necessarily saying that's what you guys were saying, but I do think it's a worthy conversation to have because I see it show up even in our relationship, right? Like, I know my wounding, he knows his wounding, and there are times where I find myself expecting him to help fill those needs or soothe those wounds, and I have to kind of check myself and be like, but is that his job? I don't know.
It's absolutely our individual jobs.
I think it's not incumbent upon me to fix the parts of her that feel unsafe in the world, but it might be incumbent upon me as a partner to create a safe enough space for her to do that, some of that work.
Yes.
Right. Like if she's feeling unsafe and I'm calling her names and undercutting her and furthering that wounding, which is essentially why we all have jobs, because that's kind of what people do. And I think your point's a good one. You know, it's like, there is that line.
Mm-hmm. And it's there, careful. Mm-hmm. It's careful. Like, if I know you have abandonment wounds, mm-hmm. I'm not going to use threatening to leave an argument or leave a space as something, mm-hmm. you know, I'm wanting him to know that I'm in this and we're working on this together. Mm-hmm. So it is, there's a difference between, I think we can support our partner's healing and create the environment, you know, and we could do the opposite. We could actually contribute to more trauma and more harm, you know, but ultimately it's my job to know whether the world is, he could create a safe environment and he's created a beautifully safe environment, but not until maybe recently have I understood that my safety in the world is like, I am safe in the world and I'm going to be okay. You know, and that's something I've been working on for years. So it's a fine line. We can't blame our partners for our own needs being met all the time. But I think we can support and create like a fertile ground for, we can just support that environment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm being redundant.
No, you're not. That's perfect. Yeah.
You know how cars have on the window when you go buy a new car, it has all the, you know, it's a liter, the gas mileage, all of that.
Yeah.
We should have those stickers where it's like, here's our wounds. Here's what you're getting.
Yeah. Here's what you're getting into. Yeah.
This is salvage, exactly. By the way.
She would have never signed up for this. No way. I'm telling you that.
She would have taken a test drive. Yeah.
Ugly test drive.
Says there was an accident about 10 years ago, but they covered it up and did a really good job on the body paint. You know,
yeah. There may be some flood damage here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is definitely something, you know, I was actually just talking to a client this morning about this idea of needs and talking about, even for some of us, you know, that aren't really good at this stuff, because most of us aren't, but especially in the beginning of this work, it's like, I don't know that I have a need until it's not met. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what I talk about with clients, mm-hmm. right, is sometimes you're not going to know until you're in that place of being pissed off or yep. resentful or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And
yeah, you know, I have to work on that.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of brings me back to the word practice, whether we're talking about needs, mindfulness, finding beauty in the contrast, it's all a practice. And so I love that your title is The Practice of Love. Love being lined with action, not just a feeling.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah. So if you're listening or watching, check out his book. The Practice of Love. And he goes into the door of mindfulness, but it's a lot more than that. Congratulations on this book. And where nice. Can we, by we, where can the audience find both of you?
I'm at ashleytorrent.com, and all the things that I offer are available on my website or at ashleytorrent29 on Instagram.
And I'm Lair Torrent, Holistic Therapist on Instagram, and lairtorrent.com. And the book's available both hard copy and audio form, wherever you can get books. Mm-hmm.
Can we leave with one mantra? So, you know, you have a billboard. What would you like splashed on that billboard?
Mm. Do you want me to go?
Yeah, because I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it would be, it may be a little long. I haven't had a chance to edit, but it would be, love has fallen into the bin of things we should just know how to do, and we don't. And it should be a practice, just like anything you want to do well. You want to hit a good backhand in tennis, you pay attention to it. If you want to do anything, you want to speak a new language, you practice that thing. We should look at our partners and our relationships in the same light of like, I'd really like to be able to do this well. And if I want to do it well, I got to practice some fundamentals. It doesn't have to be my book. It'd be nice if it was, but it doesn't have to be. It could be the practices that make your partner feel shown up for. Something like that. Edited down.
Shown up for.
I also love, I haven't had a chance to edit, period.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Ashley, what about you?
Gosh, just picking one. You know, something along the lines of, you know, our healing is our responsibility. Yeah. And if we no longer want to be the victim of our story, we have to take our responsibility for transforming that story. So that's what I'm
Why is your better than mine?
I don't think so.
Much better than mine. No. I'm so proud of you.
It's not a competition.
It's radical responsibility, right? I mean, I think this is, I don't know. I'm really like leaning into this idea more and more of radical responsibility and, you know, cutting the tie of expectation for anybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were just talking, this could be another conversation because we were just talking about this morning, mm-hmm. the power in that. So
yeah.
Agreed. Well, I want to let me jump in before you do the outro, because I just want to say again, and I noticed for the people that are watching on potentially YouTube, this video has been a little weird for the last 5 minutes. It's driving me nuts. I don't know if you guys are getting the delay on your end. I just want to say again that I appreciate you both and you know, the point at which you came into my life and all of the healing catalyst that you, both of you were in my life at that time and have continued to be. And I appreciate you both. And I'm very glad that you are on this earth.
Well, we are so proud of you, truly.
Yeah. And that word is always hard for me to say, because I don't want to sound
condescending, but proud.
But so just in awe of everything that you've created for yourself and the person that you've become and the work that you do. It's so incredible. So, I don't know how to, there's not a word other than proud.
Yeah. It was one of my clients I sent her, I put you two in contact with something. She wrote back. She's like, she's a badass.
That's a great word from Vanessa. I used to think she's such a force. She's a force that needs somewhere to put this beautiful energy. It needs somewhere to go where she feels so good about it. Like, I just remember you sitting there and just having all this just energy that wanted to help and wanted to serve and just needed a channel for it, you know, and you've really created that channel because you are a force. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you for, I mean, thank you, John, for having us. It's really nice to meet you and to, you know, be in the space.
You're well matched, it seems.
Yeah.
The energy.
And thank you for having this conversation. Hopefully this will be one of many that will be a box set. One of the things that you reminded me of when you were talking about Vanessa and the energy she had at 25 in the forest, one of the things that lines up with her story is being told to turn it down. Mm-hmm. You're too much. And maybe she has or is in the process of finding where she can point that and that becoming a superpower, you know. I relate to that. So I always feel like my bib, I was able to turn my bib around. So my bib turning into a cape. Right? So
that's awesome.
It's a tiny cape.
It's a tiny cape with spaghetti.
It's a tiny cape. But,
the ability to turn what you thought was your defects into your superpower. And I think that's common for a lot of people. What they think is their shortcoming eventually ends up being what makes them unique and powerful and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a law of nature. I think it's the law of the universe, and it's what creates compelling stories, you know, the process of that, turning your bit into a cape. So anyway, speaking of capes, thank you for everything you guys do, all the work you do, the stuff that you write, and just showing up in this world. And of course, being a catalyst to Vanessa.
Yeah. Thank you all, and have a great birthday.
Yeah, enjoy.
Thank you for spending some of it with us. Okay.
Oh, good way to spend a birthday.
All right, guys. Be well. Okay. Bye.
You
be
too.
Well.
Bye.
Hey, if you have a passion for helping others and you want to create a more meaningful career or add to your current skill set, it's time to become a life coach with Lumia. When I became a life coach many years ago, there wasn't anything like this. So I developed this program alongside with Noel Cordeau, Lumia Coach Training. And it's amazing. It's 100% live and online, meaningful, evidence-based education, real people, real community, ICF accredited too, with 20 diverse instructors and a thriving alumni community. Go to theangrytherapist.com and click on Become a Coach and explore Lumia Coach Training. I'll see you in class.